You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Kaden Tokawingawa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Kaden, I'm your host for today and I'll be with you for the next hour. Also shout out to Castor who's in the studio with me and shout out to my dad who is listening right now from home. E whā akine, coming up on the show, I speak to Labour Deputy Leader Carmel Cipollone about the government's new climate change strategy and former Green MP Darlene Tunner. I speak to Chris Ogden from the University of Auckland about the UK election result. I speak to Sam Morgan from the Disability Persons Assembly about Disability Pride Month, University of Auckland's Margaret Mutu about the mistranslation of tutility in the Treaty Principles Bill, Auckland Council Shane Henderson on increasing speed limits and the Local Government Review Panel, and University of Canterbury's Bronwyn Hayward on the National-led Government's new climate change strategy. He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wire mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Ka awa e ware ware, e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero ano, he pakehiri rokiroki mārunga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho, mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text Rima, Toru Rima, 5395. Call Toru Kore Iwa, Toru Waru Fetu Iwa, 309 3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch up with the Labour Party.
Climate Change Minister Simon Watts has announced a new climate strategy. The strategy is based on five core pillars, including infrastructure is resilient and communities are well prepared, credible markets support the climate transition, clean energy is abundant and affordable, world-leading climate innovation boosts the economy, and nature-based solutions address climate change. The strategy has been met with controversy, with Greenpeace describing it as useful as teats on a bull. I asked Labour Deputy Leader Carmel Cipollone about this new climate strategy, as well as about now former Green MP Darlene Tunner. I started by asking for her thoughts on the government's new climate strategy.
They're taking us backwards, not forwards, on climate action. They've actually not announced a single climate or adaptation policy. Instead, they're content with winding back policies in transport and agriculture, our two biggest emitters that were helping reduce emissions.
Greenpeace has called it a kick in the guts for all the people around Aotearoa who have had their homes and communities flooded recently due to extreme weather events. Would you agree with this?
Yes, I would. I think they also said something like the climate strategy announced by the government is as useful as teats on a bull. So they have been really harsh in their criticism, and of course they would be. It's three pages of nothing. And then some of what the government is doing actually makes no sense. So they are committing to more electric car chargers across the country and having this network of chargers, and yet they've taken away the incentives for people to actually purchase electric cars, and as a result we're seeing fewer people purchase them. So their policy is not only empty, it's negligent and also makes no sense.
Do you feel Labor did enough to combat climate change while in power?
Look, we certainly did a lot over the 6 years that we were in, and we're committed to doing more. Now we've got a government that, as I said, are taking us backwards. We've seen a scrapping of the $6 billion National Resilience Fund. And this has repercussions for us as a country, but also for us on the global stage, because it really feels like we are doing very little to play our part in combating climate change.
Do you still feel that way now that all your work you've done across the last two terms is being undone by this government?
Oh, it's hugely disappointing and in some ways frightening to think that the government have so callously just come in and dismantled policies that were actually going to take us forward in fighting climate change. And so, you know, we're still committed. Our job now is to fight to get re-elected in 2 years' time and then to make sure that we put policies back in place that show a real commitment to actually combating climate change.
You say you'd do more for climate action. What would this look like?
Well, this is the policy development that has to happen over the next 2 years. It's what will be new, what will be put back in place that has been dismantled. And those conversations need to take place not only internally within the Labor Party, but also with all of our stakeholders, all of the New Zealanders that care deeply about us being world leaders on stage with regards to actually, with regards to living up to the expectations that we have of ourselves to do something about climate change.
You're a spokesperson for both Pacific Communities and Auckland. We've seen those groups especially impacted by climate and extreme weather events so far. What are your thoughts on that?
So I'm no longer the spokesperson for Auckland. That is Shannon Halbert. However, I still care deeply about Auckland because I am an Aucklander, and I am the spokesperson for Pacific. We have a responsibility not only to ourselves, but also to the Pacific region, who really are at the front line of impacts of climate change. We see countries that are struggling to grow food now, that are having to move from where they have always lived traditionally because of the sea levels rising around them, that are struggling to access clean drinking water because of the impacts of rising sea levels. There is fear because of the weather events that have been occurring and the intensity that they are experiencing. And so we do have a real responsibility, not only to our people here in Aotearoa, but also to the Pacific region.
Chris Hipkins told Morning Report that Darlene Tanner should be resigning from Parliament. Did you agree with his comments?
I do agree, and I think the Green Party have been really clear on what their expectations are here, and we support them. Migrant exploitation is completely unacceptable. And, you know, she is no longer a member of the Green Party, and their co-leader, Chloe, has made it clear what their expectations are, and the right thing to do is actually resign.
Should the Greens be invoking the Waka jumping legislation?
Ultimately, that is a matter for the Green Party, and so they can speak to that. However, I think public sentiment is really clear. Darlene was elected under the mandate of the Green Party. If she is no longer a Green Party member or a member of their caucus, then she should do the right thing and walk away.
Would Labor invoke the Waka jumping legislation in a similar position? Because you haven't in the past, but obviously they haven't been similar circumstances.
No, they have been different. And, you know, I think it's case by case. It's certainly something that we would consider using, but it would depend on what the case is.
That was Labor Deputy Leader Carmel Cipollone on the government's new climate strategy and former Green MP Darlene Tanner.
That was our weekly chat with the Labor Party.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Councilling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
The government has proposed to increase speed limits across Aotearoa as a response to Labor's reduction and bans on increasing limits. They've also opted not to go ahead with any of the recommendations from the 2023 Local Government Review, which aimed to improve local government and local government elections. I spoke to Shane Henderson from Auckland Council about increasing speed limits in Auckland and the improvements local government still needs. Do you support the government's intentions to increase speed limits?
No, and I think that the Auckland Council submission is fairly clear about where we stand as a council. And I sort of in particular spoke quite strongly in the debate around the need to follow evidence-based approaches whenever we're talking about speed limits, right? So it's true, the faster you go, the bigger the mess. And when we're talking about things like around school zones, we're talking about our most vulnerable Aucklanders, our young children, that use it not just in school pick-up and drop-off, but the whole day and everywhere else. And they need to be protected. And we've had far too many deaths and serious injuries in this city. We're one of the worst in the Western world. And so it's incredibly important that we actually retain the speed limits that are safer. So no, I don't support what's been put through.
There has been some discussion Simeon Brown is not considering public feedback on this proposal with an open mind. Has he been listening to council feedback?
Yeah, I can't sort of comment on the minister's sort of decision-making processes, but what I can say is I'd urge the government to look at the actual data and the actual evidence, which is very clear on safety procedures around transport. And also, of course, the feedback from the public has been very strong. I've been listening in particular to school principals who have been, some of the biggest advocates for safety and slow speed zones. And so these are the sort of people we need to listen to and make our decision based on that. So, yeah, I can't comment on his processes, but those are mine anyway.
Submissions close on the bill today. Are you encouraging people to submit?
Oh, 100%. We've seen, even in a long-term plan process we did recently this year, changes as a result of public feedback. I'm a firm believer of democracy and of the power of the public to change things. And so, you have to be. And so I would encourage everybody to put in their submission as best they can.
And what did your own submission include?
Yeah, so we don't do individual ones as councillors. We sign up to the Auckland Council ones. But our submission as a council was very strong in terms of not just the sort of speed zone situation that I've discussed, but also local democracy and the ability of local residents to decide what to do with their own roads that their own rate money pays for. So, this is really important that we preserve that as a ideal as well.
And the government has said they won't continue with any of the recommendations made by the Local Government Review Panel. Did Auckland Council support many of these?
Yeah, there was sort of mixed feedback from the council around sort of the details and the ins and outs of it. But I think the most important element for me of the future for local government review proposals are the funding and financing situations, right? I've talked at length about how the property rate system is just not fit for purpose in 2024 to fund local services. And councils are forced across the country with ever-increasing rates simply to maintain what we have. We've just got to think differently, and we've got to think of a better way. So the review was really strong with that, and council supported that. And so to have that thrown out with all the other proposals, I thought was really disappointing.
Will council be pushing for the changes you believe to be necessary to go ahead?
Yeah, we'll continue to push that. So things like GST on your property rates, that's a tax on a tax. And if we were to have that returned, at least a portion of it returned to local government, that'll make a huge difference to the public financing and running the city. And that's one of the proposals that we're going to push very hard, and we have done so for many years.
What about the more controversial recommendations, such as lowering the voting age to 16 for local elections?
Yeah, these are the ones that were a bit more mixed and a bit more controversial, even at our level of local government as well. And plenty of my colleagues had issue with that, and I kind of respect their opinion. Just speaking personally, I'm a huge supporter of lowering the voting age. I think that, allowing 16-year-olds up to stay in public life also really helps with voter turnout as they go through their life. The evidence shows that. So, and obviously they have the most stake. They got the most skin in the game in how the city is run, because they're going to live in it longer than the rest of us, right? So that's kind of my personal view, but I respect that there are colleagues even at my table that have different views.
Does more need to be done on that vein to support increasing voter turnout in local elections?
100%. So the more turnout we have and the more engagement we have with the public, the better decisions we make, because we can reflect what the public actually want. And when you vote in people like me, I can be given a stronger mandate to sort of say that I do actually represent the views broadly of my community. And, I'm very conscious about that personally myself. So we've got to really push that hard. But how you do it as a continuing challenge, and I don't think across the world we've really sought the answers just yet, but we got to keep going.
Do you see the government doing any work in the space?
Yeah, things are, ideas are turned around like civics education, which is kind of a government proposal that could be rolled out. And I'd be really interested to see in the evidence of how that applies to a local government election in that kind of scenario. But that's certainly something that I would support us exploring, definitely. That's one of the things the government could do.
That was Auckland Councillor Shane Henderson on increasing speed limits and the 2023 review into local government. The setting of speed limits 2024 public consultation process closes at midnight tonight and can be found online at consult.transport.govt.nz.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
It upsets me so much that there's still people that we need to convince this is a real fucking thing. Real friggin' thing.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat and text in your thoughts 5395.
Power up at MOTAD this July with Live Day. Energy. Sunday, July 21, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Play with magnets and plasma balls. Use kinetic, thermal and chemical energy. And feed the energy machine in Te Pua Wānanga.
Plus, learn about electromagnetism, geomagnetic storms with the Solar Tsunamis exhibition in the Discovery Dome.
MOTAT Live Day Energy, July 21, included in general admission. Find out more at motat.nz.
Girl in Red, you know, Swedish bedroom pop, wants to be Hannah's girlfriend. Well, she's heading to New Zealand as part of her I'm Doing It Again Baby album tour.
And B-card holders, you could win tickets if you tune in to 95BFM Breakfast all week.
Girl in Red, the I'm Doing It Again Baby album tour. Spark Arena, July 23, tickets from livenation.co.nz.
I wanna say all bad things.
The original
originator.
95. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
The ACT Party is introducing a bill which, in their words, will ensure our nation's founding document delivers on its promise of equal rights for all New Zealanders. They claim they are only clarifying the treaty and not rewriting it. However, academics are saying their interpretation distorts the language and meaning of the text, and the ACT Party's bill could significantly alter the practical application of Te Tiriti. I spoke to Margaret Mutu from the University of Auckland about the intentional mistranslation of Te Tiriti in this bill and why it is so harmful. I started by asking why the Treaty Principles Bill is deeply misleading.
The requirements that are set out in the bill do not represent the treaty at all. What ACT has done, and I think they're relying on the fact that at least 75% of the country has never ever read Te Tiriti or Waitangi. So they don't realise that when ACT says that Article 1, it says Kawanatanga katoa o rātou whenua, that's six words, that is Article 1. It's not Article 1. Article 1 has 37 words. And then they say that Kawanatanga katoa o rātou whenua, which means the self-management that was devolved to the Queen of England, that's the Kawanatanga, o rātou whenua, of their lands, meaning lands that Pākehā acquired, ACT says that means the New Zealand government has the right to govern all New Zealanders. Now, that's a barefaced lie. And so ACT is trying to introduce into Parliament lies, disinformation, and if the parliamentary process is not fact-checking this stuff, we've got a very dysfunctional parliament. The second article, you know, in the second article, I did a word count on them because I'm just so blown away at how blatant these lies are. There are 91 words in the second article. ACT has taken out just 22 of them. And those 22 that they've taken out say, ki ngā tangata katoa o New Tirini. Now, and te tino rangatiratanga o rātou whenua, o rātou kāinga me o rātou taonga katoa. Kinga tangata katoa o New Tereni means all the people of New Zealand. Now, you need to be very careful about that because in 1840, Ngā tangata katoa o New Tereni, all the people of New Zealand, was the Māori people. The English people who were here at the time were only visitors. They were not the people of the country. So that you can translate those 22 words out of the 91 that's the actual article. That is translated as all the Māori people of New Zealand are guaranteed the unqualified exercise of their sovereignty, ultimate power and authority over their lands, their homes, and everything that they treasure. Act, however, says that that means the New Zealand government will honour all New Zealanders in the chieftainship of their land and all their property. It has nothing to do with that. The word New Zealand government doesn't appear anywhere in Te Tiriti, and yet Act is telling Parliament that the New Zealand government is featured in Article 1 and Article 2 of the treaty. And then for Article 3, which is 46 words in Te Tiriti, Act takes out only 7 of those words. They don't even make sense together. Ara tau ngā tikanga katori te tahi, because they've chopped it off halfway through a phrase. That's what's happened. And those 7 words mean something along the lines, the laws equally. You know, it's hard to translate something when it's totally ungrammatical. So the laws equally. Act says that means all New Zealanders are equal under the law with the same rights and duties. Again, a barefaced lie. That is not what that 2.5 phrases says. Those 7 words that they've taken out of the 46 words do not mean all New Zealanders are equal under the law and have the same rights and duties. So what Act is doing here is relying on the fact that, one, the vast majority of New Zealanders, like about 80-85% of them, have no knowledge of the Māori language at all. And so they can put up whatever they like to Parliament and say, well, it means whatever we choose it to mean, even though that is a barefaced lie. I think what Act is relying on is that the people who do know Te Tiriti inside out and back to front are, the vast majority are Māori. And what Act is relying on is that the rest of the country simply will not listen to anything that Māori says because of the white supremacist norm that exists in this country that saw an extreme right-wing government getting elected in November last year. So we have a very serious problem with this attempt to bring these sections of a bill, and it's a very short bill, these sections of the bill, to introduce them into Parliament to say this is what the treaty says and this is how it is to be interpreted. As the New Zealand government has the right to govern all New Zealanders, the New Zealand government will honour all New Zealanders in the chieftainship of their land and all their property. All New Zealanders are equal under the law and have the same rights and duties. In other words, Māori do not exist in terms of the treaty. That's what Act is really aiming at, is to wipe Māori out of the constitutional base of this country. It's very, very serious.
And how likely do you think it is this bill will pass, and what will happen when it does?
The likelihood of it passing, National keeps promising that it will not get beyond select committee. What we have said to the National Party, and I'm talking about National Iwi Chairs Forum here, is you shouldn't even let it go to select committee because it will create so much division in the country. It already is. So you've got people who believe everything that comes out of David Seymour's mouth, and that is only 8% of the population, but they are a very loud 8% of the population. They are attacking in the streets, in the supermarkets, you know, on social media, they are attacking Māori as being people who do not deserve to be recognised. The racism against Māori has just skyrocketed in the past year, in the lead up to the election, and now since then. It has just skyrocketed. We are very, very bruised and battered in the Māori world. Should this come into law, and I would really pray for the well-being of this country that it does not come into law, and you try effectively, what they're saying is that New Zealand is a white country and that only white people will be recognised in this country and only white people will have a say. That is what it means. It is what the British colonisers tried to achieve when they came here, in violation of the treaty, of course. And effectively, up until 1960, this country was officially a white New Zealand. That was formal government policy. Up until the 1960s, when the United Nations outlawed racism, and New Zealand had to backtrack on the white New Zealand policy. But in practice, the white New Zealand policy is still there. Now they want to entrench it constitutionally that this country is a white country and Māori play no role whatsoever. Māori simply will not allow that to happen. We cannot allow it to happen, and we will take every step that we need to take to ensure that the well-being of this country ensures that we remain as the tangata whenua, as the Indigenous people of this country, and recognised as such. We will do that.
And how can people, especially Pākehā, express opposition to this bill?
It's really quite simple. You can tell the ACT Party, not that they'll listen, that they must not lie to Parliament. If this does go to Select Committee, as National Party has said they will allow it to go Select Committee, then you need to flood the Select Committee with the statements that the what is contained in the bill is disinformation of the worst possible type that tries to wipe the existence of Māori out of this country's constitutional makeup. So there are those, you can contact your MPs and say this sort of thing should never be allowed into Parliament. Disinformation of this level should never even make it into parliamentary papers in the first place. So there is a lot that Pākehā can do here. There are a lot of Pākehā out there who are very, very supportive of Māori, who are absolutely furious about what ACT is doing. But you can't sit back and let others try and fix it up. The people, and I have to say here, the people who are going to fix this up is not Māori. It is Pākehā, because it's Pākehā who have to correct what those Pākehā in Parliament are doing. David Seymour is not acting as a Māori in Parliament. He is acting as a white supremacist. So it's Pākehā that need to deal to the white supremacists in this country.
That was Margaret Mutu from the University of Auckland on the mistranslation of Te Tiriti in the Treaty Principles Bill.
So around, you know, up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
This month is Disability Pride Month, a month-long event celebrating disabled communities. It began in the United States to commemorate the passing of the Americans with Disabilities Act in July 1990, and now celebrates people with disabilities, their identities, their culture, and contributions to society across the world. The month aims to end the stigma of disability and ultimately change the way we think about and define the term. I spoke to Sam Morgan from the Disability Persons Assembly about the month and what it means in an Aotearoa context. I started by asking what Disability Pride Month means.
So I think Disability Pride Month is a little bit different in Aotearoa. It was originally started in the United States, and it's kind of marked by when the Americans with Disability Act was kind of put through, and that was when disabled people pretty much demanded that they were treated correctly and accessibility be thought of. And so in America they have a lot of regulations, so
places have to be accessible, websites have to be accessible, and in an Aotearoa context, we don't actually have any regulations like that. So yeah, I think it's different in Aotearoa, and very important to consider sort of pre-colonisation, Māori or what we'd call disabled people. It was just seen as part of human and whānau diversity. And yeah.
Why is it important to have a month dedicated to this kaupapa?
I think it's a good month for raising awareness, really. I think it's a good month to kind of talk about or celebrate sort of the uniqueness about disabled people, and also raise awareness sort of around like things like the social model of disability versus the medical model. So like the medical model kind of states that someone is disabled because of their condition, but the social model sort of states that it's actually society that disables people. And an example of that would be if someone was a wheelchair user and they wanted to go to their favorite fashion store, but there was a step, so they couldn't get in, there was no ramp, that's when they're disabled. They're a wheelchair user. If there was a ramp, they wouldn't be disabled. If there was a ramp, but the say the changing room wasn't big enough, for then again they would be disabled in that instance. So I think Disability Pride Month is important to kind of learn about those things, because I think a lot of the time disabled people can be kind of seen, or disability is framed in a way where it's sort of the disability lies within the person and themselves, but it's more so how they interact with the world.
And is there anything different about Disabled Pride Month this year?
Oh, I think there's been a lot of changes with flexible funding has kind of been cut. So it's been a very, very rough time for disabled people and their whānau this year, and I think that's why it's really important for people to kind of think about these things like the social model of disability and sort of learn a little bit more of disabled people's experiences, because obviously it's been an interesting last few months.
Can you talk a bit more about what further gains are needed for disability rights in Aotearoa?
I think there needs to be some standards. So some standards that ensure that there is accessibility, that websites are accessible, that new builds are accessible. There's a lot of... a lot of stuff like that, I think, yeah.
Has there been much improvement in this space in recent years?
I think there has been in terms of kind of seeing more allyship, but I think that when people learn, I keep harping on about the social model of disability, but I think when people learn that, a lot of people can actually start to... feel more comfortable to come into the disability community, because I think there are a lot of people, you know, they might have chronic fatigue, and society isn't really set up in a way for a lot of people, and the disability community can be very like a welcoming space, and it can make people feel better about, I think there's a lot to be learnt from the disability community.
And is there anything else you'd want able-bodied people to know about accessibility?
I think probably learning about language can be quite important because, like, for example, some people might say, oh, that person in the wheelchair or they're wheelchair bound. And it's important to say kind of, you know, like a wheelchair user. If you reframe it like that, it's less negative, I suppose. And if you use language like, oh, it fell on deaf ears, it's kind of putting a negative connotation on a whole community of people. So I think learning about language, respectful language, and I think the main thing is for people is just ask, what does support look like for you right now? If you're going to a gig and you know that maybe one of your friends is a wheelchair user, maybe make sure or find out if there's, you know, accessible bathrooms and stuff like that. Share information about accessibility. And, yeah, I think just doing a little bit of research on how to be an ally can go a really long way for disabled people feeling less disabled and more comfortable in themselves, and that'll increase pride, I think. Yeah.
That was Sam Morgan from the Disability Persons Assembly on Disability Pride Month.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Text in your thoughts, 5395.
Jess B finally has a debut album. It's called Feels Like Home, and it's full of heart, sharp rhymes, and warm melodies. Out now. Come find me. I'm just better myself. Don't mind me. Feels Like Home ruminates on themes of community and identity with 12 banging tracks featuring Cranium, Sister Nancy, Sump of the Great, Rose Dawn, and Goldfang. Feels Like Home, the debut album from Jess B. Out now and available on vinyl and online where good music is found. Whānau Marama, New Zealand International Film Festival is back for 2024. And we have prize packs up for grabs for B-card holders. That includes a 10-trip pass, a New Zealand International Film Fest tote bag, and a movie T-shirt day sheet. Tune in to 95BFM Breakfast all week for your cue to enter. Winner drawn on Friday. Whānau Marama, New Zealand International Film Festival, August 7 to 18. Info available at nziff.co.nz.
Oh, my favourite jazz solo of all time. You know that one that's like boop it
barrel solo. Yeah, I feel like they definitely improvise.
You guys still talking about jazz?
Yeah, oh, just trying to work it out, man.
Do you know Grover?
Grover Washington, no, Limelight, Grover, great album.
Grover from the Muppets.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I guess so.
Does he like jazz?
All kinds of people love jazz. The 95BFM Jazz Show, Sundays at 12 with Blind Mango Chutney, Def Jim, Miss Dom, Francis Chan, or Dr. Mark Baines. The 95BFM Jazz Show, 12 till 2 p.m. Sundays. Jazz, they just make it up as they go along.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Last week, the UK Labour Party won their election in a landslide result, giving the Tories their lowest election result ever. I spoke to University of Auckland Global Studies lecturer Chris Ogden about these results, including what led to them and what is expected to change in the UK. Can you start by explaining what the final UK election results were?
So the final result was a huge landslide for the Labour Party.
And why do you think that result turned out the way it did?
I think a lot of it's got to do with what's happened over the last 14 years. So decades of austerity, Brexit, the bad handling of Brexit, the bad handling of COVID, and the general kind of air of corruption around the government, but also an air of people have had enough.
UK Labour actually got less votes in 2024 than they did in 2019. Is that a sign people dislike the Tories more than they like Labour?
So this is a really good point. So some people have called the result a loveless landslide. that actually it was more about getting the Tories out rather than enjoying or liking Labour policies.
You mentioned some of the things that people disliked about the Tories, like the handling of Brexit, the handling of COVID and potential corruption. Could you elaborate on these things a bit more?
So austerity meant gigantic cuts across all major ministries. You're talking like cuts 40, 50% cumulatively over 14 years. Brexit was promised as these as a kind of opening up or a kind of new dawn for Britain. But in every single industry, it's made things more expensive. There are a few people coming to Britain. There are kind of crises like emanating from that. And then on top of that, with the handling of COVID, I think the major thing there was just the scandals surrounding the Prime Minister at the time, having parties whilst everybody else was in lockdown, but also the huge numbers of people who died, so upwards of 150,000 people.
And what changes can we expect from the incoming government?
So this is another fascinating thing about the result, which is they've come in at an extremely difficult time. So it looks as though the health service is crumbling under massive waiting lists. There's not enough recruitment. There are scandals concerning water quality. So 90% of all freshwater sources are polluted. Prisons are meant to be cracking. There's underinvestment. And they've promised when they've come in that they won't increase taxes and they'll try not to increase spending. So it's an extremely difficult situation.
Could there be any changes in areas like Brexit policy?
So interestingly, Starmer, the new Prime Minister, has said that he thinks in his lifetime there will be no return to Europe. Now, it's unclear what exactly that means. It might mean possibly a lighter kind of economic re-entry, but certainly a return to where Britain was 10 years ago, I think, is completely unlikely.
And do you think there could be any wildcard policies introduced? Like, I know there was some discussion about Starmer supporting lowering the voting age to 16.
Yeah, I think that one can definitely happen. Starmer's an interesting character. If you look back, he supported things in the past that he no longer apparently supports. So things such as proportional representation, very keen on that. No longer keen on that because he's just won by a landslide. The hope is that maybe those radical elements will maybe downplay during the campaign and can truly come out. And I would suggest that that's what Britain needs to kind of find a better, brighter future for people.
There was also a few independents elected, notably Jeremy Corbyn. Do you think this could have any impact on the government's policies?
I don't think directly. I think the biggest thing there is that there's a greater plurality now within the parliament. So it's not just Corbyn and other independents, but there's four Green MPs. There's four MPs from Reform, who are basically a far-right party. And the big two parties only got 57% of the major vote. So I think maybe there's a deeper change happening politically, and hopefully that will make debate more vibrant.
And New Zealand is very used to the MMP system now, where minor parties can have more of a say. Is that the case in the UK, or are minor parties still pretty much ignored?
So minor parties can definitely be part of the debate, but it's still a first-past-the-post system. So if you win the most in a constituency, which is like an area where people are voting for a specific person, you win. That's it. So, again, the top two parties, Labour, the Conservatives, got 57% of the votes. The Reform Party, I think they got 11%, but they only won four seats versus, say, Labour, that got like three times as much vote, but actually ended up, I don't know what the mass would be, 100 times more in terms of the seats. So I think in time there should be more pressure for it, making it more representative.
And could this election be a clue for what the results will look like for any other upcoming elections, such as in the US or Canada?
I'm really not very sure. If we look to the result yesterday, say in France, most people thought it was going to be the far right coming in, but actually that led to a massive resurgence of the left. So I think it's very difficult to tell. I would say one thing about the Labour Party in Britain is they're not really that close to their socialist roots as they were. In many ways, they're kind of conservative light. And I think the middle ground's moved more right wing, and that's where they are. So that's not really that dramatic a change.
Does the UK and then French election results show that regardless of whether or not it's a swing to the left or the right, that there is a sort of ear for change across the world?
It's possible, but my take on it would be actually it's looking as though things are more volatile. So in Britain, 4 years ago, the Conservatives won their own huge majority. 4 years later, they get completely destroyed. So it's feasible that exactly the same thing could happen to Labour. And also, many of these seats, the dynamics are extremely marginal. Some people won their seats by 100 votes, 200 votes. So really, it could kind of go any way at any time. So I think there's more uncertainty, particularly when there's more kind of societal pressure.
And lastly, do you think the election result could impact New Zealand's relationship with the UK in any way, or do you think it'll pretty much be business as usual?
I think it's business as usual, but one thing that's definitely going to come out is that the UK is in a bad situation. So in some senses, I would say Britain is more vulnerable to kind of outside negotiations. So maybe it's an opportunity for New Zealand elites to get a better trade deal or have more leverage with the UK in those ways.
That was the University of Auckland's Chris Ogden on the UK election result.
Around, up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
As mentioned earlier in the show, Climate Change Minister Simon Watts has announced a new climate strategy. The strategy is based on 5 core pillars, including infrastructure is resilient and communities are well prepared, credible markets support the climate transition, clean energy is abundant and affordable, world-leading climate innovation boosts the economy, and nature-based solutions address climate change. The strategy has been met with strong opposition from environmental organisations such as Greenpeace, as well as opposition parties in Parliament. I spoke to the University of Canterbury's Bronwyn Hayward about this climate strategy and also how it compares to Labour's. I started by asking her to explain what the strategy is.
Yesterday, the government announced what its kind of vision is going to be. It re-announced it because it had signalled this before the election. But their focus is very much going to be on a technological and infrastructure investment approach, using the market, particularly using things like the emissions trading scheme to try and reduce emissions, and putting a big emphasis on nature-based solutions as well. The critics are saying, well, that's fine, where's the policy? I mean, they're going a lot further than that. Some of them are extremely critical about it. But in some ways, what this government's announced is what you'd expect from a centre-right. This is very much a National Party vision of how to tackle climate through what we'd call ecological modernisation, or through the technological and economic fixes. By contrast, Labour's big focus had been on a just transition, like how to transition away from oil and gas in ways that protect workers' jobs and protect vulnerable people. So both of the main parties are putting their kind of branding on their approach to climate. The problem is what actually is going to happen on the ground, and that's the big debate.
My next question was on this note anyway, but do you expect the strategy from the National Party could lead to effective outcomes?
All the critics have been saying this won't work, but to be fair, we need both the protection of vulnerable people, the focus on investment in technology, and we need leadership by Indigenous and local communities. Now, what's completely silent in this policy is how they're going to work with Mana Whenua, how they're working as a treaty partner, which is really surprising. Also, their critics are saying, how will this work when you have already rolled back the ban on oil and gas? How is this going to work when you're cutting the services and support and budget for the Climate Commission? Because one of the things we know is that there are now 24 countries that have been reducing their emissions and developing adaptation plans and putting them in practice for over a decade. And that includes the US and it includes the UK. And all the countries that are doing that action well have effective independent watchdogs like a Climate Commission. So if that Climate Commission is pared back, it won't work. If the government doesn't raise the price of carbon and also puts their sort of focus on emissions trading schemes in a wider mix of integrated policies, it won't work either. But by itself, there's a good argument for what they're trying to do, a big emphasis on renewables. But when I say it's a national stamp, what's obvious is that this is the kind of centre-right view. The real difficulty for National is whether they can bring their two smaller parties along with them on this journey. And we haven't seen that at all with New Zealand First and also to some extent ACT being so critical of the shift away from oil and gas. So there is a real pressure on Christopher Luxon and on the Minister for Climate Change, Simon Watts, to actually lead now on this, to deliver something. They will be attacked and attacked by their critics. But I think it's also important to remember that they are trying to bring their agriculture lobby with them. So there's been a lot of criticism, much of it is justified, about the way in which National has appeared to be subsidising agriculture by not bringing them along, forcing them or requiring them to be part of an emissions trading scheme and setting up a new panel around, you know, what difference does methane make. But if you were being generous about this, probably National's only way that it's going to convince farmers that it can lead a climate shift that will protect the farming industry but also make a real difference is if it does develop its own panel. So the rosiest spectacles that you could put on would say that if they pushed hard, National would be the party that could also lead in farming. And there is a significant group within farming that is looking for that leadership. The trouble is that the community itself is also really divided. So, yeah, I'm maybe not as cynical as most people. And I know that's going to sound like a sellout, but I think nobody is making very good progress in New Zealand on climate. We have to bring everyone with us. But the big issue is that we just in the last 3 years started to get our emissions down. Now, if we flip-flop and we go totally to investing in infrastructure and in new technology and we don't also take care of people, make sure that we are really reducing our oil and gas, make sure that we're not building things that lock us into a long-term carbon future, then we'll see that tiny little gain that we started to make disappear. And that would be really such a problem because we need to be accelerating this so much faster.
And what do you think a strategy with greater influence from the coalition partners would look like?
Worse, to be honest. I think that we've already seen a watering down of the objectives of the National Party to have a really strong renewables and innovative focus. We've seen Shane Jones trying to create wedge politics around the issues about oil and gas. And by that I mean that he's really trying to get Labor voters who are traditional employees who would be working in the oil and gas industry in particular or are connected to those industries to feel like, you know, they're going to lose jobs, this transition is not going to help them, their party, New Zealand First, is there for them. Now, actually, that is a really big shift from the Shane Jones that I knew when I first started working in political science. I mean, at that time, Shane Jones had been extremely outspoken and a strong advocate for environmental gains as for the way in which Mataranga Māori can lead environmental change. So a lot of this is politics. Like, a lot of this posturing that we're seeing is to increase the vote share, I suspect, for ACT. So when we're in that kind of posturing role, we do have a problem. That said, we also have to be able to show that we can deliver sustainable energy effectively over time. And that might require thinking differently, even about our economy. So there's a lot of discussion about what would an economy look like that is not so driven by growth, that is actually able to share wealth. These are really big political questions that are going to be much more than just five pillars. But at least in the five pillars, National's put out what its focus is going to be. Now the big issue is, can it deliver on those?
And do you think the strategy recognises the climate challenges Aotearoa has faced already?
Yes. One of the things that is quite interesting about this strategy is the framing is very much around the economic impacts in particular of recent disasters. Do I think that there's enough money put aside or enough recognition of how serious this is? No, because I think if there was, we wouldn't be seeing such significant cuts in areas like mapping our coastal vulnerability to sea level and water incursion. We wouldn't be seeing such big reductions in Ministry for the Environment. It's very noticeable that there has been no cuts to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade, which is Winston Peters' led ministry, but very significant cuts to Ministry for the Environment, for example. Now, Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade does have responsibilities internationally for speaking for New Zealand on climate, but we have to actually have work on the ground that we can deliver and show that we're making a difference. And to do that, we need people.
And how does the strategy do in terms of upholding our international climate commitments?
We don't know. It does sit in line with the government's recent commitment to join other countries in an American-led bid to treble renewable energy. So their big focus on renewable energy fits with that. But in terms of their climate agreement with Paris, reducing our greenhouse gases by 50% below what we were emitting in 2005, we don't know yet whether this will work. So what they need to now do is to use the Climate Commission very effectively to track this. They need to set out their targets, set out their actual actions that go behind this. So this is a vision statement, and that's what the critics are arguing. It's just a vision statement. I would say it's a little bit more than that. It is a it is a pillared approach, but that's the foundations that matter now. What's it built on? If it's not going to be built on anything that makes a real difference, then it won't work.
That was the University of Canterbury's Bronwyn Hayward on the government's new climate change strategy.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nā te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour Deputy Leader Carmel Cipollone, Auckland Councillor Shane Henderson, University of Auckland's Chris Ogden, Disability Persons Assembly Sam Morgan, University of Canterbury's Bronwyn Hayward, and the University of Auckland's Margaret Mutu. Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Eli.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.